Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, you can't have conversations about farm-to-table matters without talking about Whole Foods, a company that was initially kind of mocked by conventional retailers and now emulated by them. Seems every food company wants to be more like Whole Foods. So what's so special about Whole Foods, and what do their corporate values and mission mean to consumers, competitors, farmers, and the farm-to-table? Well, to help sort this out, we're happy to have Whole Foods Global VP of Perishables at our table today, Edmond Lamacchia. Edmond, really happy that you could join us today on Farm to Table Talk. Global Head of Perishables. Could you explain that to me? I mean, right off the bat, it sounds like everything that's maybe has to be refrigerated, or what's the difference between perishables and everything else that might be in a Whole Foods store?
Yeah, I think you're pretty close with anything that's refrigerated. But really, we're the group that manages all the raw materials, or the bulk of the raw materials, particularly the fresh farm materials, meat, seafood, produce. We have some impact on dairy, eggs, and cheese as well, within specialty cheese within the context of dairy.
Well, you're at the right place then, because we keep exploring this connection between the farm to table. And it's because more and more people want to understand where their food comes from and how it's grown. So this is something we're going to get into. Could you give us some information, kind of the size and scale of Whole Foods?
We have 441, give or take, stores. We're in the United States, Canada, and the UK. Just recently, last week, we opened our first 365 by Whole Foods Market store, which is a new format. Low service, smaller product selection, but a much lower price to the consumer.
Could you expand on that just a little bit more, on how this 365 format is different from what people see currently in a Whole Foods format?
Sure. Well, I think really is a great story relative to how Whole Foods has evolved. If you look at the situation in the late 80s, when the natural foods industry was maturing, when Whole Foods really came into fruition, one of our basic tenets, aside from wanting to sort of close the loop on food and create more intimacy, sort of that transparency of knowing farm to table, was that, you know, grocery shopping was such a drudgery, especially in the early 90s, one of the basic tenets of Whole Foods, Bread and Circus, Mrs. Gooch's in LA, was to create a sort of an exciting, comfortable, inviting atmosphere. So one of the things Whole Foods has done over the years is we've really invested in service and in, you know, sort of the feel, the decor, the different venues and services that we offer in the store to kind of create a really comfortable shopping experience. Compound that with we've been standard based, and we have some, you know, very extensive standards that require a lot of handling and negotiations with our suppliers. We've kind of created this model I would say it's a little bit of a misnomer, but that people consider it for the elite class. So the idea being that we've created this model based on a core value that was committed to community, quality of food, and health, and. As we were looking at how, you know, the market was growing and people were starting to compete with us, one of the most important things for us was to continue to grow our mission. We didn't want to cede the low end of the price sort of marketplace. We felt like with our standards, with a streamlined store, we could compete with anybody on price and still present a proposition to the customer that was true to our core values, which was organic, natural, healthy, community-oriented, high-standard food.
Well, that kind of brings another question. Come back that it seems like Whole Foods customers are almost religious about their belief in Whole Foods. They really love it. What does make people your best customers? What makes them the most passionate about Whole Foods? What do you do to them that turn them into Whole Foods lovers?
Yeah, well, we wouldn't have been as big as we had gotten if we hadn't grown the customer base. I think they're you're right. The core customer, the, you know, whatever it is, 20 to 30% of our people who are really educated on food issues and really want to know what's going on, they've been the engine that's driven our growth. But the other part of that engine is their zealotry and their ability to communicate to their communities via word of mouth have driven people into our stores. And when those sort of newbies or crossovers come into our stores, they have really great experiences, whether it's service, whether it's the feel of the store, or whether it's just the experience they have with the quality of the product. That's driven our growth. That's, you know, I would say that, you know, 440 some stores, we would have never been able to achieve that kind of a number back in, say, 1996, if we hadn't converted people.
Well, they say that good marketing starts with having what sells. I mean, how do you anticipate where it's going? You've got these kind of cutting edge customers that have gotten used to feeling very loyal to Whole Foods, but you must have to spend some time figuring out what's going to matter to them next. How do you look on down the road and identify some of the trends and issues that need to become part of the way that you're putting your store together?
The wisdom there is twofold. One is we've been highly decentralized, and then we bring everybody together and sort of compare notes so that, you know, while we haven't developed technology in the digital era and through some of the category management or market survey community as deeply as we would have liked to, we developed it on the ground in a grassroots sort of way at the store level, where store managers were empowered and they made decisions and they reported on their successes and their failures, and that cross-pollinated through the organization in a way that was incredible. You know, now that things are moving a lot faster, we're embracing science to supplement that. The second thing, I think, the second foundation is that we've had a really great mission and core value sort of support pillar under our mission. And we've always stayed true to that. So that's always helped us make hard decisions. You know, when we wanted to step further into doing high quality meat and we were looking at antibiotics and organics and we were sort of saying, these are great, great directions, but there's something missing. What's missing? And we looked at our core values and we came back and said, you really can't have true sustainability in the meat industry without welfare. You know, in the end, welfare is affected by so many of the production requirements that if you're not addressing those in the production practice or in the pasture management, that you really don't have a sustainable product. So we embraced welfare, and you know, it wasn't routinely accepted amongst all of our consumers. We had to educate them, but that was rooted in staying committed to our core value to improve the quality of food, to improve the environments we work in, to, you know, sort of make sure that all of our stakeholders got a fair share of the response.
Well, additionally, you've had the free from movement is something that I find interesting. Is that there's people are talking about how they're wanting to have the products as free from GMOs or free from antibiotics or free from being contained in cages. Do you see some of these happen before they become before they hit popular press and the buzzwords like the free from?
Yeah, I would say that we see stuff that's going to happen. I will, you know, call out to John Mackey, Walter Robb, AC Gallo, you know, the sort of top level executive leadership in the company. I mean, those guys see around the corner as well as anybody I've worked with. And I also give them a lot of credit because as we've gotten bigger, they've driven us to step further into our mission. Within the context of all of that, I think we as an organization, you know, whether it's executive or senior leadership, is we've understood that through the sphere of influence that we wield by being so committed to our mission and our core values, that we've also been able to set trends and move consumers in a direction that's consistent with those sort of emotional, you know, intellectual commitments that we make working for the company.
Well, and you put yourself in the middle of something that's you're not only providing the consumer what they want, but you're trying to help farmers along. And I'm wondering, especially when you've got meat and you've got dairy products and you've got fish and produce, how would you describe your relationship with those people that grow that, the fishermen or the farmers and the ranchers? I mean, how do you work backwards into that supply chain to be able to help them be better suppliers to you?
It's a great question, and that's one of the areas that we're constantly looking to improve our ability to build relationships. We try and work as directly as we can, and it doesn't matter really what the circumstances are. We want to know who the farmer is. So, for instance, when we entered into the animal welfare community, our index of ranchers and production units was somewhere in the beef, chicken, and pork category was somewhere in the area of 10,000 production units. But because we wanted so much explicit information at the farm level, we saw our supply of production units that filled our supply chain, we saw that number dwindle to less than 10% of what it was. Now, we've built it back up, and I would say that, you know, we're about 40% of what we were back in 2005 when we were at 10,000. But we built it up based on this fundamental commitment to traceability and transparency, supported by, you know, we ask a lot in our relationship and we give a lot, whether it's utilization of the animal, whether it's a premium in price, whether it's marketing augmentation, whether it's support through secondary programs like local loans or contracts or forward buying. So we try to look for win-win-win in the nature of our relationships with our suppliers, regardless of the arena. You know, certainly on the fresh side with produce, meat, and seafood, we do a lot of direct farmers, and we've direct purchasing from farmers, and we've set up our distribution centers so that we can do all of that receiving and distributing on a regional basis, which is much different than, you know, your traditional groceries, which don't necessarily have as many distribution points as we do relative to size.
Now, do you depend on the certification systems? I mean, like GMO-free, cage-free, the organic. What role do these certification standards play, or do they play a role in your program?
Yeah, I think there's different levels, but we love third parties. You know, a third party validation, and really a third party standard gives us a little bit more credibility when we go to the consumers and say, here's what we really believe and here's what we really want to support. Organic was the primary and the original, but off of organic, there have been an assortment of third parties that we've worked with, whether it's the Monterey Bay Aquarium and their seafood ranking program, or the Safina Institute, which does something very similar, or the Monterey Bay Aquarium, or the Global Animal Partnership. Or, you know, we've worked with the IPMI Institute to help us manage our responsibly grown program. When there haven't been standards, we haven't been afraid to go out and create them and then enlisted a third party to help us with verification so that, you know, while we might be defining a standard, a great example is aquaculture standards. We felt like the future of aquaculture was important to the food chain, and that there was opportunity to be regenerative in aquaculture, but there was nobody doing it, and we wanted to get it started. So we partnered with IMO as a third party to validate a standard. We worked with a cross-sectional group, a cross-functional group of people in the industry to set an aquaculture standard, and then we created a third-party verification system. That was our standard. I still think it's one of the benchmarks in the aquaculture community for quality standards, environmental stewardship, and consumer health. But it was our standard, but verified by a third party. So to your point is, we absolutely support third parties, but we're not afraid to go out and create a standard and then have that standard go through peer review from subject matter experts and then have a third party verify that our suppliers are meeting that standard. I think it's a cornerstone of credibility to have a standard and to be able to have that standard evaluated and then ultimately verified.
You know, last year, I think you came up with responsibly grown, and it was identifying, I'm going to let you explain it, but as I understand it, showing people kind of in how they were getting, you know, at a certain level, the good, better, best, and that almost looked to me like you were looking at farmers being in stages of getting better. Some of them were, that they were making improvements, and that it seemed like you're trying to bridge the gap with consumers that wanted to see progress was being made. When you came up with that standard, I know some of the organic farmers pushed back and thought you didn't quite right fit, that there was some problems. And since then, I understand you've talked to everybody and you're making some modifications, but could you explain the responsibly grown and where you are in that process?
Yeah. We could talk all day on that. First of all, responsibly grown and the idea of creating a more comprehensive sustainability metric beyond organic. That's not to say in place of organic or in substitution, like organic wasn't good enough. But, if you look at the number of acreage of or dollar value of product that's sold in the United States, that's organic versus conventional, and the amount of chemicals used in conventional, we felt like this was the right time and the right place to insert a requirement of traceability and stewardship along with pesticide disclosure. And we tried to do that. And we had success. Your point was well made, Roger. We had success trying to move the needle in animal welfare, in home cleaning supplies, in seafood, both in wild and aquaculture, transparency and standards. And so we thought through a graduated system where you rewarded the best performers, and then there was an inherent competition to the top, and we felt we could use that kind of ranking system in produce to kind of move the programs. We didn't want to omit organic because we believe there's stuff that a lot of great organic farmers do that they don't get credit for because of the existing parameters of how organic is defined. Made a couple mistakes. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Our reach was tremendous. The complexity of produce, the wide breadth of suppliers, the existing work that goes into the organic standards that get inspected. I think the one thing we did right relative to the system is we really tried to recognize third parties. Thing we did wrong is we didn't give organic as much we didn't create a level of reciprocity that was appropriate based on all the work that goes into organics. We looked at some of the stuff that we thought was, well, this is a no-brainer, and we gave them absolute reciprocity on it. But then other stuff we said, well, they'll have the answer because they're organic, and that way we can get a little bit more rich understanding of how the individual farmers differed. But the really big mistake we made was people don't like being good, better, best. And while it worked for seafood and, in a different environment, it worked for home cleaning supplies, and it worked for animal welfare on a different level. The one thing with row crop or tree agriculture is, that good, better, best was what the farmers were sort of taking as their personal rating. And that was a marketing failure. That was tremendous. We did also, although I think our thinking was wonderful, we did fail a little bit in the way that we presented our pesticide policy. We worked with an indexing tool put together by IPMI Institute and Oregon State University and Chuck Benbrook, which did risk indexing. And while risk indexing is a great way to start weaning off of pesticides, the marketing explanation to the average consumer is not possible. So we put too much weight into that. And while we had a great prohibited list, I'd say we were the first retailer with a brand that you could say, these 8 neurotoxins were prohibited and these other 4 were restricted. And we were working on, prohibiting all organophosphates and carbamates, which we've announced we will not accept in our responsibly grown program as of January 1st, 17.
How is this going to be translated in the stores? Will there be signage, or will there be in any kind of marks on the products of some sort or in the shelves? How will people be identifying the responsibly produced foods?
Well, to the point you made about that there was this upheaval, we listened and we're making changes. So we took good, better, best down immediately. We created just one logo for responsibly grown. So there's no longer a responsibly grown, good, better, best. We've until we can kind of really work through some of the nuances on the pesticide policy, which is, I'm really proud of where we're taking that. It's a whole new generation. We've granted the organic community an immediate responsibly grown compliance. And then, so how does it look in the store now? If you go in the store today, you would see a responsibly grown logo on anything that qualifies. You know, we have 8 criterion that have to be met in order to qualify for responsibly grown. So if you see a responsibly grown tag, you'll see it either on an organic item where it's grandfathered for another till the end of the year, and then you'll see it on a conventional item and you'll see a responsibly grown. What that means is that supplier has met our 8 criterion. And we have traceability and transparency. They filled out a very extensive indexing form on our on a third-party website that we created with the IPMI Institute and Food Logic. They've answered questions. They've created G10s that they tie to a rating unit, which is a production area. The questions relate to that rating unit, and then that rating unit is defined in the bill of lading that we receive with the product. That gives us traceability and validation that this supplier has met these criterion. We also do random audits. And we have the application reviewed by a third party, which then looks for inconsistencies based on, you know, a pattern of geographic production practices. You walk in the store, we took down a lot of the big decor that we had originally because we wanted to be a little bit after our initial problems. We wanted to work out all the kinks, improve the pesticide policy, and then we'll come back. And, you know, I would imagine that sometime in early 2017, we'll build up a decor package that will support it and a integrated media package that will support it. Right now, we're trying to get the mechanics right since we didn't do such a good job the first time.
Well, you know what? It's impressive, too, that if you try something and it isn't quite on target, that you're willing to go back to the drawing board and take inputs and say, okay, I think we can do better. So you're kind of walking your talk, I think, when you're taking another look at it. One thing I wanted to ask you was about the local supply of farms, and I don't know how you can possibly do that. It just seems to me, you know, I'm used to seeing supermarkets have big trucks all backed up, and somehow I imagine that, you know, in the middle of the summer, someone with a pickup load of sweet corn might be able to get to a local store or something. And I mean, how do you kind of integrate your central kind of purchasing with also allowing stores to be able to get a certain amount of locally grown products?
Yeah, well, way back, I mean, I've been in the produce industry since the early 80s, and local was always one of the cornerstones of what attracted me into the produce business. You know, I was an organic heavy Revy coming out of the late 70s in Madison, Wisconsin, and so I think between myself and certainly as I identified earlier, John Walter and AC, as we've gotten bigger, they want to step into our mission. Local was always a really important component, but you know, there was sort of this catharsis that happened in the mid, you know, right around 2005, where Pollan wrote his book, and everybody wanted to know what local meant, and we created some definitions for local, but through our sort of just, you know, convictions, we had already built the process for perishables where we had regional distribution centers. So when we started working in a collective fashion to create, you know, some economies of scale with centralized purchasing and produce and then meat and seafood, one of the things that we did is we set some tolerances for how far we would want to go with global purchasing. We built infrastructures at our regional distribution centers to make sure that we supported regional production. And then we also had certain allocations of what we would allow stores to buy based on the proximity. We came up with a basic definition for local, which was 8 hours truck ride from the facility or in state. And we had to make the adjustment to in state because even though it might be more than 8 hours in Texas, you know, the community in Texas believes that if it's grown in the Rio Grande, it's local. But the bottom line was we didn't say, okay, everything has to come through Central. We basically said we're gonna work with who's there. The one great thing that came out of Michael Pollan's book was that we opened up even more aggressively to say, hey, we're buying local, but if you people really want more local, we'll help develop it. And we really invested pretty heavily in infrastructure, a local loan program, giving contracts, prepaid agreements, whatever it was, in order to start stimulating more local production. I think it's fair to say on the produce side that we've helped create a much richer supply of local produce in just about every one of our major marketplaces. I'm a big fan of food sheds. I don't believe you should grow food everywhere if it's not going to grow naturally. But anywhere that you have an inherent food shed, we've done a lot to develop the supply around that. And I will also say in the meat area, I think we've done an outstanding job of taking stuff that would go out of the area and trying to keep it in the area. Chicken production is a great example where we've got more regionalized chicken production probably than anybody of our scale. That's not a regional supply, a regional merchant.
Do you find your customers are really interested in hearing the stories about how it's produced? I mean, at different times I've seen signage in Whole Foods stores that are identifying the farmer, and you've got a lot of information around the store. I assume that's in response to curiosity.
I think it's safe to say that the consumer concern or interest, the desire to know where their food comes from and what's unique and what's what, you know, sort of the value added qualities are, is growing. The thing that's hard is it's where they're looking for that information is changing. And we're doing a podcast. The whole idea that the world is moving digital, and the second part of the world moving digital is that people are going person to person for their information. So it's not like Whole Foods says this. It's kind of like somebody understands that, for instance, the Molino Creek dry farm tomato is one of the greatest dry farm tomatoes in the fall. And they tell their friend, and their friend goes and says, well, where can I get it? And it's, oh, it's at Whole Foods Market. You know, whatever it is that's really unique and special needs to be validated. Whole Foods can't just come out and say, this is great. You know, we're looking for more and more dialogue within the communities of people who support us. Now, that's not to say we can't provide information for them, who the farmer was, what was unique about the farmer, or the growing conditions, the variety, culinary usage, and that we can't help seed those conversations. But what really is working for consumers to make a special relationship that is loyal and that really has a lot more elasticity when it comes to price is that they're having an experience with the product that's fortified by their communities, their close associates, their friends.
What do you like best about your job at Whole Foods? And what makes you the most optimistic?
So what makes me the happiest? You know, right now is apricot season, right? And Al Kershane's apricots in, and I'm on the hunt for Royal Blenheims. They haven't started yet, but when I get to see that, you know, that sort of, that great sort of coming together of all of the things that make a great piece of food. You know, I had an Italian red sweet onion last night with my dinner. And I love Italian red sweet onions. And I'd sort of forgotten that this is their season. And a friend of mine said, hey, the Italian sweets are here. And he dropped one off. And it was exquisite. So, I mean, what makes me excited is that we do all this work. At the end, you get this product that's nourishing, that's, you know, I believe agriculture can be regenerative, and we've got, you know, through the work that we do to have really regimented standards, it's the product's been grown with great stewardship. It has, you know, a sensual appeal to it that, you know, makes everything worthwhile, and that I feel like I'm getting something that's well worth the value, and you know, I've contributed to the community in a big way. You know, the wonder of it, you know, back when I was a kid and we were loading produce trucks, I always wondered how the hell they ever made it to the East Coast. You know, you got this fragile product and all this planning, and it's something really special. And how does it make it? Well, at the end of the day, when it makes it, it feels incredibly good. And that, you know, it's a right livelihood. What am I most optimistic about? I'd say the idealistic young. You know, I'm really enthused that, you know, we've plowed a path and that there's a group of people that are going to make it better than what we've done so far. You know, I came out of the 60s and the early 70s, and everything was processed, and everything was, you know, it was the height of consolidation, and it was the height of, you know, stripping health down to nutrients and, you know, base elements. And, you know, that's changed. And now we're looking at everything holistically again. And, you know, we did a lot of work to get to this point. And there are so many kids that are smarter and more ambitious, and they're going to take it to a whole new level. And, you know, I think that's a good thing for the world.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Well, I really want to thank you. It's been our pleasure to be able to have this conversation with Edmond LaMakia, the Global Vice President of Perishables with Whole Foods. Edmond, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me, Roger. It was fun.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.